So, good to see you again. You've got stamina to come back. So I've now got three shorter stories of three chapters compared with what I spoke about this morning. And they are to do with issues around cell form, the first one and the second one. And then the third one, I'm going to return to cell size mechanisms again. And this has been, these are all three of them are built on a resource that was made by Jackie Hales, who has worked with me for actually quite a long time, over 20 years. And she has a small lab in London. So the resource was not made in Rockefeller, or some work was done there. It was mostly done in London by Jackie. Now, fidging yeast, which I didn't say at the beginning, I said it was a single-celled eukaryote, not closely related to budding yeast. Just out of interest, it has a genome of about 12 megabases, so it's tiny. That's only about three times coli. It has three chromosomes. Budding yeast has over five times more. It has just under 5,000 genes. Budding yeast has about another 1,000. The numbers of genes in organisms go up and down a bit depending on the annotators, but this is where we are now. And there's many more introns in fission yeast, incidentally. Half the genes have got introns, so there's a couple of thousand of different introns. And what Jackie's been doing in a consortium that we had some difficulty setting up, the consortium was to provide a yeast strain collection where each gene has been deleted one at a time. So you have 5,000 strains, in theory, each one of which is deleted one of the genes. And that was done in budding yeast quite some years ago. And they did it by a cottage industry approach, by which I mean they got money from a variety of agencies, and each lab did a few of them. Okay. I tried to do that too for fission yeast, and I have to say I failed because the agencies said, well, we did it for budding yeast, you don't need it for fission yeast. We're interested in worms and flies and stuff, so we weren't on the radar screen. But eventually I managed to get a consortium based on South Korea, working with the Sanger Centre and Cancer Research UK in England, and also with Rockefeller. So a lot of the actual deletion work was done in CRIB by Kwang Ho, and that's the Korean sort of biological and biotech research institute in Daejeon, and it's being distributed by Bioneer, which is an oligonucleotide manufacturer, slightly difficult commercial operation to work with, who provided some of the money, which has meant that there's been some difficulties with that. But the Sanger, with Valerie Wood, who involved with the annotation, who is also responsible for annotating the genome sequence, and Jackie Hales, who's done the cellular work. So what Kwang did was to construct these deletions, basically deleting each gene with a CAN-resistant marker in a diploid. And what Jackie did, because it's genetically slightly trickier in fission yeast than in budding yeast, was to sporulate all these strains and derive a haploid gene deletion set of those strains which are viable, and construct and characterize the diploid strains which are inviable. So there's two collections there. And she said, and she's her interest in collaboration with me is in fact to identify all the genes in a non-redundant way that have an effect on the cell cycle or on cell shape. That was our objective for doing this project. And that's more or less been completed. And so we've now identified about 350 genes which, when deleted, have an effect on the cell cycle, and about 450 genes which, when deleted, have an effect on cell shape. And whilst that cannot be absolutely complete, it's near complete, and so that will be a useful resource that should see me well into my old age, I hope. Okay, so that's where we are with it. What Jackie's done with this, this is a little out of date, it's now 99.1% of the genes have been deleted. And this is, in fact, more than Cerevisiae. I didn't realize, about 92% have been deleted in Cerevisiae. So this is nearly 100%. And of these, 26% only are essential. 26%. Although this figure is higher than budding yeast, which is closer to 19-20%. Okay? and although you would think redundant, there's more gene duplication in budding yeast than in fission yeast, but the difference between 26% and 20% is not due to redundancy, because what we can do is we can, by ortholog comparisons, we can determine which genes, which are, when deleted, when present in a single copy in one organism and are essential, might potentially be masked by a duplication in the other organism. Do you see what I mean? And we've done all those calculations, and it does not look as if differences in duplications are responsible for that difference of that figure. Just, that's got nothing to do with the, but I thought. Okay, so that's the resource. I could stop there in case there's any questions. It's just a resource issue, but I'm now going to go on about use of that resource in three projects, right? Okay, let's move on. So the first project is done by a graduate student, my graduate student, Felice. And it was really to try and get at how linear dimensions may be measured in a cell. And the problem that we chose is the obvious one here, is how is the width of a cell determined? Again, a very simple problem. Because there's quite a lot of work known, which has been done particularly in the budding yeast, on polarization. That is how you can become polarized. But that has tended to focus, not completely, but tended to focus on a point change, a change in a single point. It's an interesting issue. But what I was interested in this problem was how, not, it's mixed up with the polarized, because this is clearly polarized, mixed up with the polarization issue, but I was interested, how do you determine the extent of a sort of growing domain, because these yeasts grow by elongation. So that was the question. So the problem is seen here. This is a fission yeast. This is actually if Felice was giving it, this would be a film, I'm too terrified to try and show films when I'm away from home, because they never work, so I just bring a still. So this would grow if it was Felice, but it isn't. So what you see here is the fission yeast cell, it grows by tip elongation, and they have a fixed diameter. That fixed diameter is around 4 micrometers. It's a certain variation within it. And it's somewhat bigger in a diploid. Okay? And the project I gave her for her thesis, which is coming to an end, is, her project is, she's about to write up, let's put it. It was to find in that collection all the genes that influenced cell diameter. Okay, that was the project. And out of that, to try an idea of how cell diameter was determined. And the first thing that she did, or the first thing I'm going to tell you about, is to try and see whether we could get some evidence that this diameter, it can be set up de novo. Because obviously, this has history. Every time a cell divides, it already has a diameter. And so we can remove that by making protoplasts, okay, like here. So we get rid of the cell wall, and now we have a spherical cell. And then we can regenerate the cell and produce a growth zone and determine what the diameter of that growth zone is. So you're making that de novo. Now, given the nature of the audience, you'll ask me how do I really know that's de novo, because have they have they kept the history with them? And of course, that is always possible, but we've done our best to eliminate as much of the history as possible by doing this. And the point about this is, when she's done, I'm not really going to talk to you about this, but I wanted you just to be aware of this, that the cells reform a growth zone which is of a diameter which is the same as their subsequent growth in city-state growth. And when we do the mutants I'm going to describe to you in a moment, they will reform a growth zone at an altered diameter which reflects the size of the of those mutants which are wider. Okay? Yeah. Let me come back to. All we do, I should have explained that, we just treat them with an enzyme that breaks down the cell wall. So we take the overcoat off, and the overcoat is restraining them into that cylinder. We grow them in a buffer that contains an osmoticum, otherwise they would burst, and they will grow as these spheres. If we grew them, incidentally, in low levels of the enzyme, they will remain as spheres, and the nuclei will divide. They can't undergo cytokinesis, but they can undergo mitosis. If you don't treat them in the enzyme, then they will first of all form a cell wall around that sphere, and then they will form a growth zone on the edge of it, and the diameter of that growth zone is determined by the genetic system I'm about to describe to you. Boris?
Yes,
so
could you tell us a little more about the cytoskeletal?
Yeah. I don't have any pictures of it. So you're just, and I don't think I've got any pictures later. Fission yeast cells have actin at the ends of the cell, which relocates during cytokinesis to the middle of the cell. Okay, that's the first thing. Secondly, they have interphase microtubules which extend along the length of the cell. When you take off the cell wall here, that profoundly changes. The microtubules now no longer have a long axis, so they are spread all over the place, okay? And the actin will be very thinly spread all over the cell surface. When you when this happens, actin will be coalescing around this site. And she's got all data showing this, but I wasn't going to show it here. And when you get to about this stage, the microtubule will start lining up into that growing tip. Yeah. Well, we have not found a marker here which marks the position of the old end, which then would occur here. But, of course, I can't rule out that there's a marker that we haven't seen. I don't think that is the case. What I can tell you is that the actin and the other polarity markers, because you remember I talked about POM1 and there's other polarity markers, they start assembling transiently on the surface, and then they dissolve, and then they reassemble again, as if it's an unstable condition. And then eventually it will sort of locate and stick. So it's moving around the cell. And you could always argue, yes, that's because this bit of membrane was in the tip of the cell, and it eventually finds it. I can't rule that out, but we haven't got a marker that shows that. Any more questions? I haven't got any, actually. She's done a lot of work on this, actually, but I haven't got any slides on it to show you. But that's just to indicate that you could set it up de novo, and in mutants which have an altered diameter, they will grow out with a different diameter. Okay. So, she did a screen, and she did it originally with Jackie Hale. Jackie Hale's, who I showed you at the beginning, screened all those deletion mutants and looked for cells which were funny shapes, as well as cell cycle blocks. So that included all sorts of things, banana shapes, triangles, you know, spheres, dumbbells, you know, a whole zoo of shapes. And included amongst them cells that could have been fat. But she was doing a visual screen. And I wanted to show you, it's not the easiest thing to do. This is quite a magnified colony here. This cell is a fat one, this is a normal wild type. You've got to have quite a good eye to see that. So she may have missed some. And what Felice did was took the couple of hundred cells that Jackie thought might have included phenotypes like this and re-screened them, measuring the diameter of cells, okay? And here you can see them grown in liquid culture, and you can see this is obviously a wider cell, though this is exaggerated. So here's the actual data. Jackie screened just under 3,500 viable deletions. Remember, there's 5,000, there's 3,500 deletions, so she looked at each one individually. 142 were putative, but only in the crudest sense. It was, Felice grew all of those up independently and measured the diameter, and confirmed 12 of them as being definitely wider, at least 10% wider than wild type. And what was really quite surprising, at least it was for me, because this was done all blind, is that 8 of those 12 genes were in a single pathway. I mean, 8 were in a single pathway. And that single pathway is the CDC42 pathway. CDC42, it will be familiar with many of you, it's been implicated, it was isolated originally by John Pringle in the dim recesses of time, is involved in polarization in budding yeast. It's been implicated in cell form in all sorts of cell types, but not actually implicated precisely in this process that I'm talking about here. Yeah. All of the mutants here, which are in purple, are at least 10% fatter than wild type. CDC42 was not, because it's lethal. If you delete it, the cells are dead. And you remember, this has all been done in a viable collection, because we actually weren't interested in so much in genes that are necessary for viability, but those genes that will modify the growth zone. Okay. And I've got to say this, yes. They're shorter too. They're wider and shorter. They conserve volume. Correct. Absolutely correct. Yeah. So they conserve volume to the first approximation, but what we haven't done is done a systematic measurement to see if there's like a 10% difference or something, which you would need if there's something more subtle. But basically, they're all shorter. Yeah. We are talking about the mean, and in some of these cases the distribution is quite wide and tends to be skewed to the top end, so it's like this rather than skewed to the small end. We have overexpressed all of them to see if they got thin, and they have not. Could have made us a lot of money. Getting fat makes us no money, but getting thin might. So we have no evidence for dose, gene dosage to make them thinner. And incidentally, I implied it, but since you brought that up, we were also looking for thin mutants too, and we didn't get any thin mutants. No thin mutants. Now, thin mutants. I ought to say there's a developmental switch. When you add pheromone, you get what's called schmoos, which are a thinner outgrowth. And so if you were to switch it into sort of that form of growth, then they could be thinner. And I expect you to get thinner, but we did not get thinner. Yeah. The nucleus is these cells are 3.84 microns in diameter. The nucleus is 2.5. The three. So it's significantly smaller. We did look to see whether in the fat mutants the nucleus was fatter, which is perhaps what you were wondering, and it is not. Well, shall I continue? You're interested in epistasis type things? Yeah. We've done a bit of that, so maybe I should just see where we go. I haven't got too much to say here. So all of these, Myo52 doesn't really quite interact here, but all these other guys do. And so this has got to mean something. You don't do this as a random screen and then get this answer and don't think. CDC42 pathway is where it's at. So there's something about this pathway that determines the width of the cell. Presumably the growth zone. Now, CDC42 is a GTPase, okay? I didn't say this, but I implied it. It's involved in philopodia, particularly in actin cytoskeletal polarization. And it's thought to include downstream effectors in fission yeast that includes the kinase PAC1. So this is a highly conserved, extremely well-studied pathway, but has not been so precisely previously identified as being involved in determining a growth sort of growth domain, which is what I think is happening here. So, what did she do? She thought she would look to see where some of these proteins were, and also look at how their localization was affected. Well, she hasn't done it comprehensively for all of these, but a number of the genes that were in this network, and that includes SCID1, which is the CDC42 Jeff, SCID2, which is a scaffold for CDC42, and PAC1, which is an effector kinase, are nicely localized at growing ends. Okay, they're in the tip of the cell. But one of them, that's RGA4, which is the gap protein here in red, has actually the opposite distribution. Its distribution is along the sides of the cell and is excluded from the ends. Okay. I hope you can see that this is a merger of PAC1 for the same cells. You can see there's red at the end, and there's it's patchy, but it's green at the side. Yep. No, we don't. And it isn't sort of complete either. You know, it's sort of, it's a bit dynamic. So it may be, if you were to time average, it might be distributed better. So it's excluded from the ends. But it is patchy. I have to say that there's data out there. We weren't the first to. Her data is much better, but the Felicia's data is much better. There has been one group that sort of thought RGA4 was located around the whole of the cell. So we weren't the first to show it wasn't located at the ends. Fulvia Verdi showed that prior to us. Well, we've not done too much on that, but we've done some things on it. So most of these proteins are dynamic, and we started doing some FRAP and stuff like that. And I can't tell you a story yet, but hopefully by the time she finishes her thesis at the end of the year, we'll have a bit of a story on the dynamics. But we don't have it yet. But she's clearly interested in that. Now, let's see what else we've got here. Yeah. So what we thought we would ask is, if we delete RGA4, you get a wider cell. And that's done there in this experiment. And what she's asked is whether the distribution of PAC1, which is the sort of effector marking the growth tip, is now increased in size in those cells. And the answer is yes. It's extended further around the tip. So in the absence of RGA4, which in these cells will be lining the sides of the cell, you get a greater extension of the tip marker around the side of the cell. This is only descriptional. I have no model about this. I mean, I've got thoughts about it, but no real real model. And this is the sort of picture where we're at, which is a bit unsatisfactory for me, I've got to say, because I don't have a model. But the notion is that we have CDC42, which is being regulated by proteins like SCID1, SCID2, and the others, and is determining the size of the growth zone. And RGA4, which is an inhibitor of that on the sides here, is actually preventing the migration of this activating zone to go into the sides of the cell. And the reason I don't like this is that we're deep in a chicken and egg territory here, you know, because I don't know what defines this, whether it's a consequence of this, and I don't know whether this is just a boundary sharpening sort of phenomenon, you know, of positive feedback. Now I'm looking for a role for positive feedback here. Or what is really the primary determinant? So this is, I'm at sea with this one at the moment, and I'm just presenting where we're at. And we're trying to get models to see whether some proteins diffusing, perhaps they're delivered to the end here, we think most of them are, and the diffusion and activation might determine the extent of the growth zone. And so we're using a marker of activated CDC42 GTPase, and we're using FRAP to determine diffusion rates and to see if we can get some insight. So that's where we are. Boris.
So this is highly interesting, and using it especially because yesterday, right, Luther gave a talk about basically the growth of, well, I guess you'll call it a tumor, right? But basically tip growth from the very, very different point of view, right? It was all in a way sort of phenomenology and mechanics of growth. Mm. And there was very little of molecular regulation.
It was more physical rather than chemical.
It was a physical model, and of course that was focusing on the fact that in order to grow, you have to deposit the material, like the material. Yep. And this is actually one thing that we didn't mention at all. So the question is, where is the stuff that's making the wall?
At the end, I mentioned that.
What?
At the end, I mentioned that how actually you go from, or at least an idea of how you can regulate at the genetic level, the parameters, the physical parameters that actually lay down the cell.
But you didn't tell us anything about where the wall material is actually getting deposited there. So what do we know about the wall material, how it is delivered to the tip? And so, there is actually some interesting information in trying to put these two approaches together, because what you were saying was sort of the defining parameter, so his shape there was determined basically by two considerations. One is basically size of the zone. I don't know why I'm telling the service.
But you're doing a really good job.
executive summary. There is a characteristic length defining the region where the stuff was deposited. Right, and then there were some important properties of sort of mechanics of viscoelastic properties of the medium that was deposited, right? Which was also modulated.
We cannot modulate it in all peak growing cells that happen with it, like plants, fungi, well, other than
So the interesting thing. In connecting that
to this
is is this stuff, for example, regulating the size of deposition region? And another thing is it regulating the properties of the wall material, as in where the stuff is getting phosphorylated or sugared or whatever, methylated, you know, whatever happens to it chemically?
Well, I'll have a go, then maybe you should have a go. I mean, I think this is quite a difficult area and quite difficult questions to ask in terms of cause and effect here, because this is a problem that's been of interest to biologists over quite a few years, in fact. So people working in algae, in filamentous fungi, for many years they've modeled hyphal growth. And also, I mean, you're probably more familiar with that because they emphasize physical properties too. There's an organelle called the Spitzenkofer in filamentous fungi, which is thought to be very important, and people have implicated it in determining the size of the hyphae. But it is all, on the whole, rather descriptive. We are also being descriptive, but we have identified genes which are players, which is, I think, a step in the right direction. Now, what do I think is happening? I don't really know, but I'm going to list the phenomena, and then maybe you could add for things that are important.
I mean, can I just
Yeah, please.
I think both approaches are right. I mean, I think that what has to be done.
Not another.
Well, wait a second.
They're complementary, right?
They're complementary. So the point is like, you know that there are some laws of physics that you're going to go around. Conservation laws that generate enough that you can have the molecules you want, actually, and you can show that in different species you grow in the same way. You use the same physics. And you can get pretty far with that. So physics tells you there are a few parameters that you need actually to create a shape, that control the shape. Physical parameters at the largest scale. So what the cell has to be doing has to be controlling those parameters. And it is probably CD40 you're doing, obviously in the screen you find in the pathway CD42. CD42 is going to be controlling whatever is what these parameters that
and which do you think it's most likely to control?
You have to link the two.
Yeah.
And this I believe is so you have to be controlling either the secretion at the poles, so the secretion profile, or you can be controlling how soft you are, or how rigid you are, profile of that. And basically, with these two parameters and osmotic pressure difference, you're done. So you have to be. So this pathway has to be like controlling that. And what I think is interesting is that, for me, the interesting point is like connecting the two worlds.
Yeah. And I can't do that at the moment because I don't even have a good sense of how this pathway is determining the extent. I mean, I know the issues that we've got to be thinking about. We're going to have there's going to be membrane remodeling here, which is occurring over a certain area, and that can involve both endocytosis and exocytosis, so and that could involve actin, and that may be the primary driver.
But you have to control that.
But you've got to control it. And whilst lots have known about the molecular mechanisms which are important for that membrane trafficking, almost nothing is known about what controls the extent of that process, which is what I was interested in, and which is where I think this might be revealing, and also in the next project. The second thing that's important is that this wall here is going to be of a different type. It'll be softer than the hard wall we got here, and that's a crucial part of this. And that could be dependent upon the membrane trafficking, or it could sort of be the other way around. In other words, the softening could be influencing or both together. And that's another issue in here that one. And then the next property in all this is that we've got the stuff here, which is where there isn't growth. And now I'm going to throw a stone in the water, which really troubles me. And I don't know if you've thought about this.
We find that there's no growth. So
that's where we would be. Now we do the following experiment. We take a fission yeast cell and let's say we block cytokinesis, okay? So we get multinucleate cells and we let them grow till they're quite big. A cell which is originally 4 microns in diameter will end up being 6 microns in diameter along the whole length of the cell. That is only possible, of course, if you have remodeling down here, where we don't think there is remodeling.
But in general, there can be no remodeling.
And if there is remodeling, it's being remodeled to give a diameter down here, which matches the diameter up here. I don't think these are trivial problems, actually.
No. I have a very ignorant question. So you said membrane, and you said wall. So there's a wall outside the membrane.
Yes.
How is the stuff delivered through the membrane to the wall? So presumably there are vesicles carrying the stuff from inside. Can you visualize?
Yes, it's not been done brilliantly in fission yeast, but it's been done in budding yeast, and it's done better in is it pollen? Or?
Pollen seeds have been done like very, very carefully.
Because they're much bigger than the...
We don't understand. I mean, people see secretion. People see vesicles, the accumulation of vesicles. You can label the membrane. The problem is that you have endocytosis and exocytosis at the same time. You don't know actually what are you secreting. You don't know what you're secreting.
But the notion is that you're getting, I think, membrane trafficking, which is delivering components to the cell surface, and that which are then secreted, and there's remodeling because you've got to get rid of membrane there and replace it with membrane. And of course, do remember in fission yeast, one other thing is that when a cell is born, it only grows at one end. And then it's got to activate the whole process at the other end, which is sort of something to be thought about. So when I said I find there's a lot of chicken and eggs in all of this, trying to work out the causality of it, and what I found really quite difficult.
Maybe there is not, right?
Maybe it's not a linear line, is what you're saying.
You can couple this to the what you have, but the mechanics at the larger scale, and the mechanics can be affecting this, and basically what you have is a closed system. You don't need one process to drive anything like in a linear way. All we have is doing this, doing this, doing this, and it's affecting mechanics. Mechanics can couple back, and basically you have a closed system that...
Well, the other thing that...
like the self-assembly you were talking about.
So let me throw something else into this that you might have a view about. You see, one thing that slightly surprised me is that every deletion we've got has more or less got the same diameter. So we've gone from, it isn't quite the same as that, but we're going from 4 microns to about 5 in all cases. And it's almost as if we start screwing up the system, you go to a second default, you know? It's not that you're playing with a rheostat. It's as if you've got two states, like a bistable state, and you go from one state to the other when we start playing with this. So why I find that a bit difficult is that this smells to me of a sort of continuous diffusing thing, yet if it was a continuous diffusing thing, I wouldn't have expected it to behave like that. And so I don't know if you've got any insight to that problem.
There are other things you find this kind of be stable with the like the two different sizes, but in pollen tubes or in other cells like that grow with seed growth, you see oscillatory behavior. For instance, it's kind of like it grows and it's like foam.
Yeah, and that's seen in filamentous fungi too.
That is in filamentous fungi seen in pollen tubes, and we kind of.
And we haven't seen, we've looked for that here, but it's just beneath our resolution, I think, because we haven't seen that.
But this is something that may happen or may not. But I bet that...
Because a pollen tube, you know, is like 25 microns in diameter. This is only 4, and we haven't seen that.
But we see in fungal hyphae, we see very, very thin cells. We can get that with, you know, the fungal hyphae, first they're very thick, and then they start branching, and then they start, like, being thinner. In that case, we can see.
Well, I was interested in that because it's an oscillation, and you know, I thought you know, because that could change, but we haven't observed it. Haven't observed it. No, we haven't. We've got mutants which have got more than 2 growing zones. You know, 3 growing zones. Yeah.
It's normal, like in fungal hyphae, you get like branching and you get 2 growing zones.
And we isolated mutants which are shaped, you know, T-shaped mutants we call them, as T1 to T4, as those 4 genes there. And you know, I've wondered about questions like, is there an overall potential for polarized growth, which is then shared amongst sites? You know, in other words, you've got 10 units of ability to grow, and you share it in 1 site, 2 sites, or 3. I didn't get very far with that. I just wondered whether...
No, it seems that to make progress in bridging these two...
No, it could be interesting. I didn't know you were doing it. Maybe we should have a... Because I'm not sure, of course, what you've done. Yeah, that would be...
One truly would want to actually see this wall material, or, for example, presumably that's some sort of sugar which you can't label very easily. But are there any proteins that go into the wall?
Yeah, there's proteins that go in the wall.
You know, make fluorescent and bleach and
you know,
come in. And
there are proteins there. Yeah. I mean, like enzymes that break down sugars go in there.
Yeah.
You know?
So because that would immediately. You know, give some idea of, you know, where they deposited, whether there are any changes in localization, and one can reach it, right? One can do some sort of dynamics with the...
Well, I'm hoping by frapping here we're going to get some sense of our dynamics with the markers we have. I'm very troubled by this.
But there's a difference between sort of looking at these regulatory proteins and actually looking at the wall, because ultimately growth is...
Well, PAC, right.
This stuff is regulating.
So PAC 1.
This discussion is very good, but just a warning that.
Okay, I'm moving on. Okay, I'm moving on. So, next problem, thank you for that. Next problem is, in fact, much the same one. And this part of the work we have published, but not the screen that we're doing. And this is also a size issue, and this time it's concerned with the size of a membrane-bound organelle. So what I was struck by was the fact that there was huge amounts of work on membrane trafficking, but almost little understanding of how that generated membrane-bounded organelles of a certain dimension, which was actually my most what I was personally interested in. And I thought, could we get some insight into that, and decided to use the nucleus as an example of that, because it's a single organelle and the easiest one to do. So this is what Frank Newman, that's this guy here, has been looking at, what influences the size of the nucleus in a cell. And I'm going to give the physiological experiments there, and then of course we're doing a screen once again with that deletion to look for different mutants of a different nuclear cytoplasmic ratio. So the first thing I want to show is quite an amazing correlation. You know, this is almost physics quality data. We nearly never get data like this, I've got to say. And what he did was an experiment where he took mutants that ranged in size from tiny cells, like nitrogen-starved cells here, or wee cells, to very big cells, like here, and different cell shapes. These are orb mutants, which were from the cell shape mutant collection, and produced a measured, of course, the size of a cell and the size of the nucleus. Okay, assuming that the nucleus was an oblate spheroid, and then plotted, and all of these here are plotted on this graph here, and you can see, and this is essentially the ratio of the volume in the nucleus to the ratio of the cell, and it's about 8% throughout, okay? And they are all the same, which tells us that the nucleus is scaling with the size of the cell, okay? And if you now correlate that, you can see that here, this is all the data, and you can see the volume of the cell is ranging from down here. This is just an expansion of this lower part here. and here we have cells which are 700 micrometers in diameter. Here we've got cells which are about 20 micrometers in diameter, volume. And then the nucleus volume is ranging here from about 2 to here, close to 60, okay? And the point I want to simply make is that this is correlating almost exactly linearly with the volume of the cell. And it's amazing, okay? And these cells all have the same DNA content. All have the same DNA content. So whereas I thought ploidy does have its effect, but it's indirect. So this is it. The size of a nucleus, how much membrane you put into the nucleus, is determined by the size of the cell. And I think this is really interesting, because now you have a traffic light, how I view this is there's a traffic light in the membrane trafficking, which is directing membrane to the nucleus in a rate that keeps the size of the nucleus proportional to the size of the cell. Now, what's the why do I say DNA content is irrelevant? This is actually a cell which we've induced to endoreduplicate. That is, I don't need to explain quite what we're doing there, but this is a cell which we've blocked mitosis, and we've set it up in conditions where some of the cells don't replicate, so they remain at 2C, and some replicate a lot, up to 32C, okay? So in here, this guy is actually 32C, or some large number, whereas this is 2C, okay? And you can see that this is DAPI staining, right? So what this allows us to do is to look at those cells which are 32C and those which are 2C, and you'll see this is in fixed cells, so the ratio is no longer 8% because of shrinkage. And what you see here is that the nuclear cytoplasmic ratio in 32C is the same as 2C cells. In other words, ploidy is irrelevant. Yeah.
C is the unit of what?
Oh, sorry. Ploidy is C. I apologize. 1C is one genome. 2C is 2. 32 is 30. So these cells have got 32 times their DNA content in that nucleus, whereas this one's only got 2. Okay? Now, until we got this data, had always thought that the nucleus would scale with ploidy. I had this DNA content, and I thought that these guys would all have lots of DNA in them. But DNA is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. And I actually think most people wouldn't even recognize that today. Okay? So that's the next. Of course, a diploid cell has a larger nucleus. But the reason it has a larger nucleus is because diploidy leads to a larger size at mitosis. And the larger size at mitosis means the cells are larger and therefore the nucleus is larger. So whilst we've always thought that haploidy cells have got bigger nuclei, it's because haploidy cells give you bigger cells and bigger cells give you a bigger nucleus. See? What? Yes, and you'll get to them, or at least you'll get a smell of them in a moment. Yeah? We haven't counted nucleopores. We did a bit of staining, see if there was a gross difference. We didn't see one, but we didn't count them. If it's subtle, we didn't see it. We certainly didn't look in this situation, which we don't know if there's 30, 16 times more in there, which we could have done, but we didn't look at that. Okay. Next question. What happens to the nucleocytoplasmic ratio through the cell cycle? That's boring. He just followed it through the cell cycle, measured it, and when cells divide, the volume of the when the nucleus divides, the volume of the nucleus does go up. And what this is simply adding together the two sister nuclei. Otherwise, it just goes up fairly continuously. Nothing to see here. So this is surface area of the nucleus. When it divides, the surface area significantly increases. But the volume of the nucleus per volume of the cell barely changes. Okay? Nothing much to say there. The next experiment was more interesting. This is a mutant where we've blocked cytokinesis. Okay? And what we'd noticed, in fact, many years ago, but I'd never really paid attention to it, just noticed it, so I suggested he looked at it, is that nuclei in the middle of a cell looked smaller than nuclei at the ends of the cell. Okay? Do you see what I mean there? Yeah? Yeah? So what he did was to divide the cell up into domains around where you drew a line between the end of the cell. You know, this is halfway between the two nuclei, and this is and the end, okay? And what the concept we had was that that each nucleus might have a cytoplasmic domain, and it was that cytoplasmic domain that was important for it, okay? And that seems likely, because if you look here, what we have is the outer nuclei, got a couple examples here, and the inner nuclei. And the inner nuclei have a proportional cell volume, like the blue, which is smaller than the outer ones. But if we now draw the line, we see that it sits on the line. So it looks at a first instance as if there is a domain of cytoplasm, rather than the whole cytoplasm in the cell. The domain of cytoplasm surrounding the nucleus is determining how big that nucleus should be. And given that, we thought we'd push this to extremes. Look at this cell here. This is a cell where we've destroyed one of the kinesins, so the nuclei all clump together. And you'll see that the nuclei in the middle here are quite a lot smaller than the nuclei at the ends, right? Just to show it. So we think somehow the traffic lights determining membrane trafficking for the nucleus is determined by local cytoplasmic volume or local cytoplasmic membrane, which presumably means this area is this nucleus is competing with that nucleus, and the one with the biggest domain is bigger. Isn't it remarkable? Yeah. Yeah.
Does it mean that the membrane must be stretched or something? Because you could imagine crumpled membrane.
This membrane, we have other situations where we see ruffling of the membrane, which actually occurs during mitosis, but these are not ruffled.
So the membrane, but does it mean that pressure is higher in
the Well, it means certainly that they are, in this situation, they're under, whatever is going on, they're under sufficient pressure to keep them smooth. Mm-hmm. When they undergo mitosis, they will ruffle. Especially if we collapse the spindle. Right. Now, homeostasis. I was talking about homeostasis this morning, wasn't I? So this is a homeostasis experiment. So the question was, if we perturb the nucleocytoplasmic ratio, if it's true that the nucleus is determining how big its cytoplasmic domain is, if we perturb that ratio, then it should readjust itself. Okay, that would be an active homeostatic mechanism. So what he did was in a situation where he'd made mutants look, this is a cytokinesis mutant, so you'd have four nuclei like this. What he would then do is centrifuge them, so the nuclear distribution is no longer normal, it's sort of it's sort of focused like one end, and then let the cells divide. So what you then end up with, and you can see a situation here, is some cells you have a bigger domain than you should expect, and in others you have a smaller domain than you'd expect, right? Then you can look to see how does that nucleus recover. Yeah? And the you see the answer, you can see the answer here. If you are, let's start with the right-hand one, which is very straightforward. If you have a nucleus which is smaller than it should be, okay, so this percentage here is 5% of the of normal, then as soon as it finds itself in that cell, there is a very rapid response, and within 20 minutes, it doesn't go quite to 8%, but it goes up to 7%, which gets it very close to normal. It responds very quickly, as if the cell, the nucleus knows it's got a lot of domain, membrane is added to it quickly, and it gets close to the right size. If, on the other hand, you have something like this, where the nuclei are too big for the cytoplasm that they're in, it takes a long time for this to readjust. And this is the growth of the nuclei, and this is the growth of the cell. And what you see is that the cell grows here for 70, 80 minutes, and the nuclei don't grow at all, as if they know they are too big, and they don't grow, and then they start to grow rather slowly. And you can see this curve here, the nucleocytoplasmic ratio. Again, it's not quite going back to normal, but you can see it's obviously got a sense that it's too big for itself, and it stops growth. So this is a bit like the experiment I was trying to describe on the board this morning. It's a homeostatic mechanism, and it's a good demonstration of that. So I think we have a really interesting phenomenon here of gross membrane trafficking and how that's regulated. Now, this was done. This was a beautiful piece of work that he did for this. He's Swiss, and I then got him to do the screen on the deletion mutants to look for mutants of a different cytoplasmic ratio. But he wasn't quite so psychologically suited to a screen as compared with this. He was actually trained as a physicist, and the small differences in a screen just upset him, you know. He loved these correlate, you know, he loved these really straight lines of Frank Newman. He loved these straight lines, you know, and wonderful correlations because it was so obvious. But when it came to looking for, you know, a nucleus that was 10% or 8% or 7%, he got very, very jumpy. So we are working through this midlife crisis for him. But we have got, first of all, some drugs that will change the. So if we interfere with nuclear cytoplasmic transport, we get bigger nuclei. So we can do that. And we've got a mutant here, Fab1, which is the one mutant that he's got, where it's clear that the nucleus is smaller than it should be. But this has been a slow process. This is not an easy screen. You know what you've got to do. You've got to look at the cells, measure the size of the nucleus, and I'm telling him that 8% is significantly different from 6.5%, and he's, you know, he worries about it. Okay, but I think this is the, and I quite understand that. But I think this is such an interesting problem. It's worth getting into it. I can't tell you anything more than that about it. So I'm going to stop there. See if anybody's got. It blocks RNA transport out of the nucleus. That's what Frank favours. I don't think I do, but I don't quite know why I don't. I sort of think it's something to do with all the membrane that's in the cell. Well, he's thinking along exactly these lines, and it may be right, but I have a feeling it won't be anything to do. You see, why this experiment blocks RNA export. So he's thinking the same line as you were suggesting there. But I think what that may well leave to positive pressure and just get the nucleus getting bigger. I could well imagine that. But I'm not sure it tells us about the normal trafficking mechanism. But it easily could do. He likes the idea of it being measured by some sort of RNA outside the cell, ribosomal RNA versus RNA inside the nucleus. Sorry, RNA outside the nucleus versus RNA inside the nucleus. But yeah.
Surface area.
It does in cerevisiae. I think you know the answer to that. I'm 90% sure it doesn't serve. Yeah, well, I'm not going to be contradicted, I'm 100% sure it will be scale with. But the numbers, I think the pores scale with the nuclear. Yeah, and I don't know what's happening here. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the plasma membrane, as it's a cylinder, will more or less scale with size. And so membrane, the plasma membrane and membrane within the cell will be sort of correlated. We might be able to make more progress in spherical mutants. So one way to take this forward would be to make a spherical mutant and see what size the nucleus is there and whether that's different with respect to plasma membrane versus membrane within the cell itself, and we haven't done that, but we're aware we should do that. He did actually, yes, he did. He got a twofold. Yeah, he did on a.
Yeah, you know, 10%.
Yeah. No, I should have mentioned, Mike. You're quite right. I mean, he didn't do quite such an extensive study, but he got some results which are not inconsistent with this. Salamander? Did you say salamanders?
Yeah.
What about salamanders?
Salamander. Yeah, I did. I'm embarrassed.
I don't know about.
You have salamanders. You're going to have a pentaploid salamander.
Yeah.
And then you get sort of nuclear cytoplasmic ratio and this pentaploid salamander that is constant.
Well, there's a lot of stuff out there on you know, the karyoplasmic ratio was a hot topic in 1901, and there was a lot of stuff there, which is really good actually. Yeah, and you can make different ploidy sea urchins and stuff like that, and you can look at it, and cells scale with it. But the ploidy is not affecting it directly, the nuclear size, it's indirectly through that. Yeah.
So given that the nucleus really is part of the nuclear membrane, it's part of the ER.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the direction I go rather than through ribosomes. I actually think this is being mediated in something to do with the ER, I have to say. And that there are, the way, and I'm not sort of specifying it very clearly, I sort of imagine traffic lights at different decisions with membrane trafficking, literally traffic light, which directs how much membrane goes to any particular organelle. You could imagine, you know, you're making membrane, and then as you go down the process, you see, you say, right, 10% membrane's going that way, 30% is going that way, 20% is going that way. Now, if it was as simple as that, you wouldn't get this homeostatic mechanism that I just described, because it's responding too quickly for that. So it is more complicated, but the concept of having traffic lights, I think, is the right way to think about it. I think this is really interesting, but to get into it in a molecular form, you've got to have the genes. And that's proving difficult. But I'm excited by that, I have to say. Was there anything else on that project? No. So this is, yeah, so I'm... It honestly could be RNA. I just, for some reason, don't think it is, but I have no good reason for it. I mean, it could be RNA. It could be almost, I mean, anything that scales with with mass could be the driver. I mean, it's clearly correlated with mass and volume, but I'm favouring it something to do with membrane, just because that's so direct to the... But even then, it isn't quite right, because, see, to say 10% goes that way and 90% that way doesn't measure how much membrane you've got there already. By the way, this mutant here has got enlarged vacuoles, so there's something else going wrong with membrane trafficking in that mutant. Well, I don't. No.
Okay, I don't.
No. I don't. I mean, and I don't know how much osmotic pressure. I mean, we did play around with osmotic shocks to see if that had an effect on the nucleus, and we didn't see anything that was worth investigating, so we left it for the time being.
So you have many of that cell with many different and now you apply osmotic shocks, you don't see anything.
We didn't see a significant change, no. But we didn't do it very, you know, we didn't do it very systematically. We were looking for a dirty, quick hit. So I'm not saying it isn't there, I'm just saying we didn't see it immediately. Okay, third topic. So this is, and you can see my general interest is in these sort of scaling, dimension, sort of size type sort of problems. And have I got any other ones going on? No, I think that's all the one. Okay, so back to cell size. This is a Spaniard, Francisco Navarro from the Canary Islands, posing for us in his sexy t-shirt. And he's done a really nice... Okay, so what's he doing? So, so he was using that systematic deletion collection to look for all mutants that gave you a so-called Wee phenotype. Now, the Wee phenotype was this cells that divide at a small size, and I got the first Wee mutants, Wee-150, because they're dramatic, you know, they're nearly half the size. But we knew out there were cells that were not 60%, but say 90% or 85% of wild-type size that could be interesting, but we didn't never had a way of getting into it until we had the systematic gene deletion collection. So, once again, we went through those mutants and did primary screens, also done by Jackie, for cells that might be smaller than normal. And actually, Frank also pulled up in his screen so far 1,400 mutants looking for nuclear. He's also looking for nuclear morphology mutants, ruffled. So we've got plenty of ruffled nuclei and stuff like that. And out of these various people, a number of candidates arose, which Francisco has then measured the overall volume by under the microscope to see whether there's mutants. And we've had a cutoff at 10%. So anything that's 10% smaller than normal, we've counted. Now, we have a second screen going on, which I'm not going to tell you about, which is for haploinsufficiency. That is, in the diploid deletion collection, for those mutants which, when one gene is deleted, make cells smaller or bigger. And we've done that screen as well. That was done under Jackie's supervision. And we've got about a dozen genes under that control too, which include all the, you know, CDC2, CDC13, CDC25, Wee1, all those genes as well, plus a set of other genes. But I'm not going to tell you about that because I don't have time and we haven't really finished it. So this is what he's been doing. In the end, what he does is identifies mutants, he measures them, and this is a more extreme phenotype. You can see that's obviously smaller, and this guy less so. So where did he get? So this is all the genes that he's identified. And the first thing I want to point out to you is unlike the Mike Tyers collection here, the generation times of all of these, although not perfect, are not bad, 130 minutes. And you'll see some of them are 30 minutes slower, but the budding yeast ones you know were like three times as long, I mean, in some cases, you know? Exactly. So that's we wanted to look only for those. If we had small, slow-growing mutants, we threw them away. Okay. So all of these genes when deleted, give you some reduction in growth rate, but not too much. And they are all reduced in cell length. But they're not, this is WEE1, and all of these are just less extreme phenotypes. And this is a collection of what the molecular function is, and you can see you've got a whole variety of genes. So once again, we now have, and the reason he did this collection was to get insight into those two inputs that came in. Do you remember the talk this morning? Nutritional estimate and what interested me, cell size. I wanted to see whether we could find a cell size mechanism, because this project started before the POM1 thing, but the POM1 came out of left field. Now, this is where he got clever, I have to say, I think. We have two pathways in fission yeast. This one I've told you about this morning, and this one I haven't. This is the nutritional stress information pathway, which has been worked on in several labs, including my own. And there's a collection of genes in here which influence cell size at mitosis, and they're involved in monitoring growth rate in some way. Okay? And they feed through polokinase into CDC25, into CDC2. Okay? This is the NIM1 is another gene, is the name for CDR1. I isolated it as NIM1. It was isolated by somebody else as CDR1. And this comes in through the other pathway of POM1, the mechanism by which you measure cell size. Okay? Now, what we can do is switch off both of these pathways by two methods, actually. One is by deleting the downstream gene, STI1 and NIM1, which switches off the size sensing mechanism and the nutritional stress. Or alternatively, we can switch it off by mutating CDC2 from tyrosine to phenylalanine, so it can't be phosphorylated by WEE1, so we escape everything upstream of it. Okay? And the reason that's important is because, and let's take it here, we've switched off STI1 and NIM1, these cells still grow and divide with a certain cell size. It's bigger than normal, but you haven't lost the ability to measure how big you are. And the coefficient of variation is pretty similar to wild type. It's just the mean length is longer. So these cells are still measuring their size, even though we've inactivated the cell size sensing mechanism, and for that matter, nutrition. So the logic here was there has to be another system in here that is measuring cell size, and maybe we can get insight into that by studying a genetic situation where we've switched off these upstream upstream pathways. And just to remind you, I showed you this morning, this is the fusion protein, which is tyrosine 15. So there you've switched off both of those upstream pathways, remember, because they both work through the CDC2 phosphorylation state. So that's switched off in this mutant here, and yet you have cells growing at more or less the right size. It may be a little bit bigger, but the coefficient of variation is increased. Now, this is the clever bit, the logic that he's gone through. By using that fusion protein, what he's done, of course, is simplified the system, right? So we've got the fusion protein just under the CDC13 promoter. You've got rid of SIG1, SIG2, PUC1, WEE1, CDC25, okay, all of that's irrelevant, and for that matter, RUM1 as well, which is a CDK inhibitor. So there's almost nothing that can be influencing this except the rate of transcription and translation of the fusion protein and its location to the right site, okay? Yet the cell still measures how big it is. And degradation and recovery from degradation. But it still measures how big it is. So now what we can do is go through his collection, you know, where was it, this, and ask which of these genes, when deleted, will delete the size of that fusion protein, which is tyrosine 15, because that means it's still having an impact, even though we've switched off all those circuits, do you see? And furthermore, it's going to tell us something about cell size. Are you with me? So it grossly simplifies the system to look at. I hope I'm making sense with it. So he's going through those genes now, and he's discovered three genes in those 12, all of which are transcription factors. He hasn't quite finished the screen, which reduce cell size at division in this tyrosine phenylalanine 15 mutant. Okay? And we have preliminary evidence that it affects the transcriptional level of the fusion protein working through the CDC13 promoter. But the amount of transcript change is very small. So if you have trouble with twofold difference, we were talking at lunchtime, this is going to be in the same neck of the woods, or even less. This is the plot I drew on the board over here before, which I was trying. And this is the homeostatic control for cell size. And I wanted to point out that this is mean birth length. This is mean to extend as much. If you're small, you extend more. This is the evidence for homeostasis. In a, which is STI1, NIM1 delete, okay? That is, it's these two genes have been deleted. So we've switched off this and this. So we're working on this control here. Still has a size control, but it's not quite so a slope of 1. It's a slope of 0.63, which means you get back still pretty efficiently, but you only get back, in fact, 60% of the way each cycle, okay, instead of 100% of the way. This is, understanding these plots is actually immensely complicated, so I'm not going to try and, but at a crude level, it just shows the control isn't quite as good, but it's still not bad. So what we're hoping is by studying this, that he's now repeating all of this in the CDC2 tyrosine phenylalanine mutant. All of this is out of the way, and we're hoping to identify the subset of genes that lead to cell size measurement in this simplified strip-down cycle. And I think it will reveal the second, if there's only one more, second size control that's going on. So that's the final project. I have an acknowledgement slide, but we'll go through that with questions. Did that, that was clear, wasn't it?
Quantized length.
So, and by checkpoint here, you mean the cell size checkpoint.
Right.
Yep.
So now when the slope of that line, if I understand correctly, has gone from 1 roughly to 1/2.
Yes.
So this is basically saying that it isn't really checking for the number. It's just some sort of feedback, negative feedback, which is sort of buffering the effect on the size.
It's
and that's a different mechanism.
Right. So it's clear. This is very difficult to think about clearly, I've got to say, because it's clearly inputting cell size, and it may be some feedback. Because if you're too big, you get back to being the right size within 2 cycles. You just don't do it in 1 cycle. So it's still measuring it, but it's not having such an effective correction as the one that goes back in 1.
So I guess with less, any negative slope integral feedback gets you back?
Yes. It'll get you back, but you'll just go back slower. Yeah? That's exactly right.
We don't know.
But just to clarify, though, are you saying somehow the slope of minus 1 is sort of attuned? It's tuned to be minus 1, so it looks like a size.
Well,
check.
Minus 1 is not a perfect factor. Right? Yeah. In 1 cycle, input.
But because it can deviate from minus 1, you're saying it's not a size checkpoint, but this mechanism looks like a size checkpoint because it's sitting at this coincidental minus 1.
It doesn't require a tuning to be minus 1, right?
Because
you only measure every cell cycle. So if you have feedback that's driving you back, where you should be less than a cell cycle, you see minus 1.
I see. Okay.
So you basically say that that could be
a well, look. Since we've got into this, this is nightmarish, all right? Because these cells are not the same absolute size. That's the first point. So these cells on the right here, you remember, are bigger than normal.
Yeah.
The tyrosine 15 mutant is only about 10% bigger. So I prefer that to this one, which is about 50, you know, something like 50% bigger. So it's a more extreme. The second point is, in these guys here, we've lost the POM1 system. Now the POM1 system, if it's more to do with geometry, what it may be saying is that you've got to be bigger than a certain size to work, okay? Because you've got to be, but it may be that it's not actually, it could be a belt and braces sort of thing. In other words, you could have a size homeostatic mechanism which works across a scale, or maybe works more towards big cells, and the geometrical one measuring the length of the cell works for small cells. So we could have two things going on here, and we're just averaging a whole load of cells, and we may be losing something at the extremes. And that's why I'm saying this is complicated, because I don't really know what's going on.
How come the first length of the extension doesn't... Oh, sorry.
Yes, can I take this one? Yeah.
How confident are you with one point up there?
Good point. But these aren't single cells. They are, they're group data, so there'll be 10, 20 cells in there. Absolutely correct. And it has to be said, we've done this quite a few times, and it's always in the range of 0.85 to 0.95 usually. This one we haven't done so often, and I'm more worried about the data over there. But I'd rather do this with the tyrosine 15 experiment, where the cell sizes are more similar. So all I'm asking you to take home from this so far is that we still have a size control, but it isn't quite as homeostatic as the normal one.
But there's also the issue of that you can have a size checkpoint and still have different size, right? Because you can imagine, if it is the size checkpoint as in, say, the range of spreading of POM1, right? Now you change, reset the range of that by, reducing the degradation rate or something. Because over there's where POM is more extended, right? You should have a perfectly good size checkpoint. It just checks for a different size.
It's set at a different size. Absolutely. But here, we've set it to a bigger size, and it isn't quite so good. But is it simply that the cells are less good at dealing with being bigger? You see, you asked how much we're relying on the single point. Here, you see, this maybe here we've hit, it goes like this, you know? And the actual fact, this bit is one, but we've lost it at this end because the cells can't cope with being bigger. And maybe, you can see why I'm reluctant to go much further with it until we've got this data out with the... But it's a way of getting into it. I mean, it's a way of getting into it. It's all I would argue. Yeah. And what did you get?
Minus 0.4,
minus 0.5. Oh, right.
We're okay. And, but you can do some tricks to sort of overexpress cycling, using a smaller data second way, and then have small foreign daughter cells in glucose. And then, I've had some really tricks in the small daughter cells in glucose. When we look at that part of the curve, which is sort of extra small made daughter in glucose, then we got a minus 0.4. When we made a curve, we sort of continuous curve. And if you're sort of far enough on the left of it, you get a minus 1, then sort of gradually.
Well, I absolutely think we could have the same thing here.
Yeah, right.
We absolutely could have the same thing here. So what are we doing with this? Just so it's clear, we're going to find out which genes, when deleted, still have an impact in the tyrosine phenylalanine mutant in our fusion protein where we simplified the system. I'm making the assumption that those genes are contributing to how a cell measures its size when we've eliminated these other controls, and we're going to try and find out how that has an impact on this very simple cell cycle oscillator. So that's where that's our way into it. And I'm feeling pretty confident about it, I have to say, that we're going to find the other system, because we've now reduced the problem to something you can manage.
There are different
size control mechanisms in different directions, spatial directions, or how many different?
Well, I think, I mean, the one I told you about this morning was a GM one that obviously can measure a distance. It could be that there's another mechanism that more directly measures when cells are too big for the nucleus cytoplasmic ratio, because if you get too big, your growth rate slows, okay? And that could be not having an effect if you're too small. And it could be that you have different mechanisms, which I hadn't thought of before, which sort of together give you a size homeostasis. It could also be that that cell size falls out of mechanisms which happen to almost by accident. You know, counting mechanisms, you know, where you're counting things on ploidy, on DNA, will give you size measuring mechanisms. So it may be that the G2N size control here, in budding yeast it runs on G1S, and that may be a different kettle of fish. I think my position at the moment is...
You can get your fission yeast to run on the G1S.
Yeah, of course, in a WEE1 mutant, of course. I mean, it's running on the G1S, and we haven't... we could repeat the screen in that background, but I thought we should try and sort this one out first, in actual fact. I'm actually beginning to favour the idea that there aren't hundreds of mechanisms, or tens of mechanisms. In fact, there's one or two, one like the geometry one, and one with measuring size, and between them, they actually restrain the limits. And it's the limits, it's getting rid of those tails here, so that we might be getting rid of all of the small guys because you run foul of that POM1 mechanism. And here, there's a separate mechanism that we've still to find out. And between them, that may solve the problem. I think that's quite possible. Well, slow down growth when it's too big, when it comes carrier plasmic limited, that certainly will have an effect. I don't think the cells here are yet reached that limitation. That will happen. I haven't presented data for that, but that will happen, but it's going to be out here somewhere. But that could be yet a further mechanism that could come in, and that these guys, maybe there's an active mechanism to prevent you getting into that position where it's an embarrassment. I mean, if you see what I mean. If we're done, should I just show you the people? Because I should, you know. They're not people. They are. Oh, no, they're not people. So two pictures. The work I talked about, this is my group with a visitor. We have a visitor here. And Damien did the CDK stuff, okay? Frank Newman did the nuclear size stuff. And Felice did the omic screen for mutants. And POM1 thing was same people here, but I got Jamie. Yeah, and Jamie did the POM1 story. This is actually a plane. I'm an amateur pilot. I fly this thing, actually.
Did they all fit in?
Sorry? No, they fit in. They fit in one at a time here. You know, this is the guy who owns it, and I'm there actually. And this is a 1934 Boeing, actually, believe it or not. It's amazing, amazing plane. You can see it. And I took my lab out on an outing. They all did aerobatics in this thing. So there we are. Thank you. Very interesting discussion. Thank you.